long as we're talking about history and things like that of this place, and we talk about the commissioner, maybe you could say something about what the political history of Manly has been. I mean, of the hot this place. Can I say?
You know, like it started out, I guess gold was struck and people came, and then they must have had some sort of organization.
You mean governmental organization or
yeah.
Political history?
Political history.
Well, I can't tell you much about political history. There was, I don't know if there was even a miners' meeting here. I would presume that there were miners' meetings in the Eureka area and maybe out at Tofty, but this is just a presumption. I really don't know. I don't know when the first school was established here, and I don't know when a commissioner was appointed here, but it must have been fairly early to have established a recording district here for the mining claims. I would presume that was the strongest impetus to have a commissioner and a recorder here.
How large an area did that recording district cover?
Well, it was about halfway between here and Rampart. Rampart's the seat for that recording district. And presumably it went to Fish Lake or beyond. Much beyond that would be in the Tanana district, and I think up to Tolavana. But I'm not too sure about that, and how far up the Kantishna the recording district was, I don't know either, nor how close between here and Livengood. It's a fairly compact district. And I'm sorry I can't tell you when the recording office was moved into Fairbanks, but must have been about 1970 or 69. That was, it would have been the same year that the DeLimas moved down here, or maybe a year or two after. Yeah, a couple of years after, although Gus Benson was still had charge of the books. They were in DeLima's house, and they were moved a couple of years after the DeLimas arrived here, and the DeLimas came in 1970. Incidentally, she was the postmaster following Gus Benson, and she held it until Bob Lee got it.
So, how long was Gus Benson the commissioner, and when did that post no longer exist?
Well, he became commissioner before Tex Browning left. I don't know why Browning gave up the commissionership, or whether it was taken from him. I just don't know. I presume he gave it up, and I'm not sure when Gus took it over. But there was a telephone system here at the time for a long time. It was connected with the Cricks and was part of the old ACS system that went between Nome and Fairbanks.
ACS?
The Alaska Communication System, yeah. And we heard stories that during Prohibition, when an agent was being sent down here, there was a contact that would call up Mrs. Brentlinger, who was living with Tex Browning, and that way the local bootleggers would be tipped off, and I don't, to the stories that I've heard, nobody was ever pinched here for bootlegging, and there were quite a few bootlegging and some moonshining operations. There are still some stills here, two that I know of. Stanley Dale has one, and Hubbard has part of one. He uses a large copper vat for his water storage, his household water storage.
I guess there's parts of them around some of these old cabin sites too, huh?
Yeah. I've seen barrel hoops, a lot of barrel hoops on a slough down here, and one over in around Miller Field over in the Tofty area.
Mm-hmm. Did people sell their bootleg beer or moonshine to other places along the river?
This I don't know, but I would guess that most of it was for the local miners, but it, some of it could very well have been shipped out of here, but I don't know that this is true.
Mm-hmm.
Stanley could tell you this bootlegging business more than I. He was here earlier, and although the bootlegging days were over when Stanley arrived, it was legal then. But it wasn't so long in the past that it wasn't talked about, I'm sure.
You got here then just about statehood.
Yeah, well, statehood came in 59. We came in 55. Incidentally, there was no road connection between here and Fairbanks. That was completed in 59, the fall of 59. It was started in 57 from Eureka towards Live and Good. Got as far as just beyond the Hootlataqua. And there was nothing done in 58 because there was a changeover from the... the BPR was doing the building, that it was a local crew. And then in 1959, a contract was let to Green Construction, and they completed the job.
Was there some kind of trail before that?
There was what's called the Fairbanks Trail that went from here to Dunbar. You can still see it from the air in a number of places. Some of it has been washed away by the river. It was usable until probably 30 years ago. At least parts of it.
Would be used by cars?
No. It would be a winter trail only, mm-hmm. by dogs. Earlier days they also used horses and sleighs, but that's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there cars here in Manly? It seems I've seen pictures of vehicles here in Hot Springs.
There were very few. Most of the vehicles here were trucks. We brought a sedan here when we came down.
Did you send it down on the barge?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember. In fact, Billy Lanning was a little kid, not yet in school, playing in the yard here one day with Jimmy. When the road first opened and a car drove by the house, and he came running in saying, "I saw a car, a real car, not a pickup, but a car." A it was a big thing for him to see a car.
What did you use a car for when you first came here?
Well, we just used it for transportation because we didn't have a truck. We later traded the car for a flatbed, 1.5-ton flatbed.
Mm-hmm. Well, did people rely more on the barge before 59 than they do now?
Oh, very definitely, yeah. The barge brought in groceries and liquid refreshments too, and some hardware, and of course the fuel came by barge. Standard Oil had a bulk plant out at the river where Lee Woods Fish Camp is now, and they had 2 20,000 gallon tanks elevated, and they had a warehouse. They had 2 warehouses for storing barrels and cases of gasoline and blazo kerosene.
Yeah, as we've mentioned, liquid refreshments a couple of times. Most all the other villages, a major concern is drinking, and people are very aware of it, talk about it a lot, and they might be interested in, you know, what is going on in Manly. And I was wondering what your feelings are about the drinking situation here. You know, does it seem to be a problem, or is it, you know, how do people treat that?
Well, I've talked to other people. I think it's definitely a problem with some people. But I've talked to people that have had wider experience in bush communities than I have, and who are also familiar with Manly Hot Springs, and have been told that Manly Hot Springs is really not afflicted with a lot of alcoholism as many communities are. But I just don't have a broad experience in small communities, but it's definitely a problem. Of course, it's a problem all over the United States. There aren't many families that don't have an alcoholic someplace out on the limb of the family tree, in my knowledge. Another problem that's most recently been forcefully brought to everybody's attention is the lung cancer situation. In the time that we've been here, there have been 4 people that we definitely know died of lung cancer. And I was told that there was a 5th one, that Big Fred, I had thought, had died of throat cancer. But Tony Lanning told me this summer that it was lung cancer. And they were all heavy smokers except one, Bertha Mason, the missionary nurse, and I'm sure she didn't smoke at all at any time during their life.
Yeah, pretty high percentage, huh?
Right. But there have been quite a few people here have had cancer. Not only lung cancer, but both Jean Hubbard and Hazel Dale died of cancer.
Not Hazel
Dale. Hazel Jones, excuse me, not Hazel Dale. And Marianne Gertler died of cancer. So, I don't know. I guess this would be what they would term a cancer village.
Well, didn't you write away for statistics on that and some questions?
Yeah, but the statistics are very incomplete on lung cancer in Alaska. There is a study made by Walt Johnson on lung cancer rates in natives of Alaska for certain periods of time. And that's the most concrete information that I have run across.
How's health in general?
I think generally health is pretty good here. And I think this can be attributed to a lot of physical activity among the people. People get out a lot and do things. There aren't many that are what you would call sedentary. There are very few that have sedentary jobs. And certainly the quality of the air is good. I would think that there is less stress here. The stresses that come with city living are pretty much lacking. There may be other stresses that I'm not thinking of, but I would say generally that the health here is exceptionally good.
You mentioned that people have, are very active and very few have jobs, which is keeping sitting around. Are there many jobs here, or how has the situation been since you've been here as far as employment?
Well, there are some jobs that open up every once in a while, but there are no long-term, full-time jobs, year-round jobs. The three highway department positions are for about a 6-month period, and actually the postmaster has the only full-time paid job here. Cy Hetherington has the hangar, and he works year-round there with some time off for vacation. And the school teacher has a 9-month position. The mines operate about 6 months, 5 or 6 months. There's some fishing, and the fish processing plant out at the river during the season from generally early July until into September. And there's sometimes a crew, an exploration crew comes in here and will hire a few people, or there's some surveying of one sort or another going on. Or this year there was the construction of the new school, and there was a little local hire there. I think they hired 3 or 4 people locally on a short-term basis, a few months. And there are a number of people here that work in construction that belong to various unions and go to work out of here every once in a while. There's a little work, but it's no big thing.
You didn't mention somebody about greenhouses. That's a summer occupation.
Pretty limited.
So it can be pretty tough for some people to find work or to make a living here. Is that true?
Yeah, I would say that is true. That somebody moving down here would either have to have some resources that he brings with him or her, or just luck into a situation. Well, I think different people here have been supportive of various individuals that have arrived, and there have been a number of people that have stayed over the years, like the young boys that came up from Kansas City directly from graduating from high school, not really knowing what they were getting into, just wanting to come to Alaska. It was Steve Braidman and Barry Shockley that were the first to come, and they've made out okay. And then Dennis Hollingsworth came a few weeks after Steve and Barry arrived. Yeah, they all went to school together. In fact, there was a fourth one that came too, but he went back and has never returned. As a matter of fact, a fifth one also came. There was, but he came the next year, and but he didn't. He didn't stick around. And there've been, Kurt drifted down here and then drifted back.
Well, it certainly applies that people become, attracted to and want to come back. Seems it happens to a lot of people who come here. Some aren't able to really make a living or don't feel they can.
Yeah, it's pretty tough to make a living on trapping here. This is not noted for being a particularly good trapping area. There's a little fur here, but very, very little.
Do you think that the situation will probably remain the same as far as work availability in the next 5-10 years?
Well, the thing that has changed most recently is the price of gold. And there have been a lot of claims staked in the last year or so. And what this will bring, I don't know. There may be considerable activity. How much of the claims will prove out to be producers is something that only time will tell. Certainly, I would assume that there will be some more gold produced, more than has been, but because of the higher price of gold. But the higher price of gold isn't going to put more gold into the ground. It may put people active on ground that was less than marginal before.
Have you any idea how many claims are around here? How many?
Well, by now there must be several thousand claims in this district. Between Eureka and American Creek and Pioneer Creek in that area, and then over in the Tofty Woodchopper and the other American Creek in the other direction. Boulder Creek and Little Boulder, Moose Creek, Fish Creek. No, nothing on Fish Creek that I know of, but there are a lot of little creeks that have claims on them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there have been a lot more filed this year. I checked in the recorder's office and there are pages of them listed. So, whether there's anything there or not is yet to be determined.
Any question?
Well, I do, but it's a little bit different topics.
Oh, well.
Okay. When was the Park Association started? And why was that done?
Oh, well, we can check the records on that, but I think it was probably around 64. And I think the biggest mover there was Lou Byers.
Is he any relation to Bob Byers?
No, they're not. In fact, the name is spelled differently. Bob Byers spells it B-Y-E-R-S. And Lou Byer is B-E-Y-E-R with no S. Somewhat earlier than that, a group of us got together and decided that if we were going to encourage people to visit here, we would do well to have some kind of picnic accommodations for them. And we built a few picnic tables and erected an outhouse where the present park along the river is now. It was no big deal, but that may have been the start of the thing. And then a little later, when Lou Byers moved down here, after he and his two partners bought the roadhouse, he was most instrumental in getting a non-profit organization, a non-profit corporation going to handle this. And it expanded to include the dump, and it, if I remember right, also there was a move, whether there was anything done about it or not, to handle that area where the rock pit is across the slough and adjacent to Tony Lanning's property down there. I think that this is under the jurisdiction of the Hot Springs Park Association, but I'm not too sure.
Well, who owns that property where the picnic tables and where the park is?
It's actually state ground, but it's there's an agreement between the state and the Park Association that the Park Association will be the manager of it. Mm-hmm. So it is state property.
Mm-hmm. What other kinds of village organizations are there besides the Park Association?
Well, there's the Bean Ridge Corporation and the Village Council, but the Bean Ridge Corporation is the local native corporation under the Alaska Land Claim Settlement Act. I really don't know much about it. I have not involved myself in it or the Village Council. Can't give you much information on either.
It's been a matter of some controversy in a number of different places about Manly Hot Springs being a village, native village. And I thought that you explained that very well one time about how that came about. And I wondered maybe if you could say that again.
Oh, well, under the Land Claim Settlement Act, any village that had more than 50% native population during the 1970 census was eligible to be designated as a native village. And it was just luck that during the 1977 census, there were more natives living here than whites, and which is demonstrated by the school enrollment here. The Woods children, the Burke children, and the Flegel children, and Dixie Dale were all enrolled here, and that gave a more than 50% native population. But traditionally, the community has been less than enthusiastic about native people moving here until in comparatively recent times since we've been here. As a matter of fact, there's been this change. And there are still some people that resent the fact that this community was designated as a native village. But we welcomed the designation, that we felt that this was a good thing, that the local native kids particularly were in line to get some land as part of their native heritage, and we still feel this way.
Just what is involved in since it has been designated a native village, what does that mean to people that live here?
Well, I would say most importantly, the local natives are entitled to 69,000 acres under the Land Claim Settlement Act. And there are other aspects of it too, but I'm sure that that's, in my mind anyway, that's the largest single most important factor. I'm not sufficiently versed on other aspects of the act. I don't know what, I'm just not aware of the financial disbursements that have been made or will be made to the native enrollees. But I suspect that the direct financial payments have been comparatively small. There has been very little attempt that I'm aware of anyway of the local natives to exercise any unified political position to take advantage of the situation. I'm not aware of anything at all in this respect. To the best of my knowledge, there is no particular interest in this.
I guess there is a community center being built by, not Bean Ridge, but is it Bean Ridge that's building it?
To the best of my knowledge, I really don't know, but I would say no, it is not Bean Ridge. There's some CETA funds, I understand, involved, but I really don't know what the funding is or what the administration is. Some of it has certainly been through Bean Ridge. It may all have been through Bean Ridge. Where the funding is coming from or what the amount has been, I just don't know. And I don't know what the administration of the community center will be. I'm ignorant of it.
I think that's Village Council. It's federal grant to Village Council. Recently there was an election to start a second, to settle a question of whether or not Hot Springs should be a second class city. What was that all about? What did that mean to people who are living here?
Well, I would be hard-pressed to say what it meant to different individuals. My impression, though, is that, first of all, it was obviously unpopular in that the final tally was 43 opposed to 23 in favor. So it was nearly 2-1 against. So it obviously didn't have much support. There would be those that would say I'm wrong, I'm sure. But I feel sure that the main reason that it started to begin with was the fact that there were those that just couldn't accept the fact that this community was named a Native village, and that they resented it and were trying to make the best of the situation by curtailing any possible political power that the local natives might exercise. There's also the concern about the two sections of land that would be set aside for community growth under the Alaskan Land Claims Settlement Act. Just how that would be handled. Some people were not willing to see that be handled by the state trustee, or trustor, I guess it is, who is Bob Jenks. But it's pretty obvious that people did not want to have a law-making, tax-collecting body established here, even though it was much talked about that no laws would be established and no taxes would be established. I'm sure people felt a good deal of apprehension about the possibility of both later becoming established. That ultimately there would be ordinances passed, and there would the possibility of taxes being levied and collected here was a concern for people. How much, I don't know, but that's my interpretation of the situation.
If you want to add anything while we're talking, you're welcome to.
He's good.
Okay, I got another question. Also, this last year, there was a movement in this area to establish the third class borough. What is that, and what would that mean to people here?
Well, I think you should define what you're saying about this area. That movement emanated from the Yukon Koyukuk school district offices rather than from the area. And a third class borough is merely a borough that would assume the functions of the school board. It would operate the school system. There would be no other functions that I know of, and it would establish a property tax on property within the designated boundaries. But to the best of my knowledge, this was proposed and was pushed by people in the main office of the school district, which incidentally does not even lie within the school district itself, but is outside of the district and is it came at a wrong time and under the under poor planning, I feel, in that there wasn't much explanation given excepting to those aspects that were most favorable. It was an unbalanced presentation on the benefits without any concern of the detrimental aspects of the possible third class borough.
What were the positive aspects? Do you remember any of them?
Well, the only positive aspect of it would arise from an increase in monies available to the school district, which would be due directly to the inclusion of a section of the pipeline as part of the tax base. But there's no basis that I know of to believe that this would automatically be included in the school district. The local boundary commission, of the state government, would be the determining body on what boundaries would be included. So certainly we weren't assured that the pipeline would in fact be a part of the district. So it's quite conceivable that there could be a third class borough and no pipeline to provide this windfall in added taxes. That would be the source of I think it was something over $2 million a year that would add to the monies available to the school district. But there's already a pretty high capita expenditure, and we have a declining student body in the school district. One thing that was not brought out by the people that were pushing this was the fact that the native lands would be subject to taxation after 1991, which is 20 years following the enactment of the Alaska Land Claim Settlement Act. And if there was a 10 mil tax, and that was the figure that was proposed, if there were a 10 mil tax, every